From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome
to
another
Bletchley
Park
podcast
extra.
We did it.
It's Christmas. It's amazing what you can do. You'd think that 2013 might have been a quiet year at the home of the Codebreakers. What with a huge restoration project underway, turning the site into a bit of a building site here and there, certainly a great deal of work going on bringing those buildings back to life. Also, it's not Alan Turing's centenary year anymore, that was last year. So do you think things might have eased off a bit more?
Should have been tumbleweed this year, really, shouldn't there? Just drifting across the mansion car park.
However, our feet haven't touched the ground, have they?
No.
In podcast terms, it's a reflection of what's going on here at Bletchley Park, and it's been 12 packed months.
Well, yeah, we've had so much content that, you know, it's been a struggle some months to work out what we left out, really, hasn't it?
There's been veterans galore visiting and us visiting them. We've had events such as the Bremont Codebreaker Watch launch. We've had some very high-profile filming on site, not only the ITV drama The Bletchley Circle, which we'll tell you much, much more about shortly, also The Imitation Game, the film with Benedict Cumberbatch playing Alan Turing and Keira Knightley playing Joan Clarke. Many very substantial documentaries that have yet to come out that we are very excited about. They've been filming this year. And Dick and Dom, you know, the odd thing like that.
It's top secret, you can't tell people that. Yeah.
That'll be on soon, hopefully. Not only that, but lots of development of the site itself and what there is to see. So we've got the new Lorentz exhibition in Block B telling you about the cipher system that Hitler himself was using. The library is now dressed as a code-breaking office. The morning room in the mansion is dressed as Alistair Denniston, the commander's office. He did a lot of the early recruitment, and it's the room where the US-UK special relationship was effectively born. So there's been a great deal going on.
And the room where we interviewed Sir Arthur Botzel.
Exactly.
Hopefully through the podcast we've managed to bring to life all the work that's going on here, really. I mean, just with the interviews we've carried out with the people who are actually doing the work, I think it's been pretty fascinating, really.
Well, they're excited about what they're discovering along the way and how it's all coming to life, and how it's saving these buildings is a great source of pride and passion for everyone involved. And it's wonderful to see them come to look like they might have done in the 40s.
June next year is just going to be fantastic. I can't wait to see Block C open. It's just going to be amazing, isn't it?
You won't recognise the place, but it will be befitting its actual history. That's very exciting.
We're talking about not recognising the place. Back in the summer, I didn't recognise Block B.
It was quite a transformation. When the Bletchley Circle's drama set dressers came in and they started eyeing up and thinking what about what they would have to do and what they would have to cover up, we couldn't imagine, I don't think, a fraction of what they would actually do. And to see the way they really just zoomed it back in time and the level of detail they created.
It was remarkable.
You'd have to tell people who know what that section of the museum normally looks like where that was filmed. To see it brought to life by the characters in such a gripping drama is just fantastic. The story's intriguing as well, and it moves quite fast. It's one of those dramas you actually have to stop what you're doing, don't be distracted by anything else, actually concentrate on it, listen to it. Not to say it's difficult to follow, it's perfectly accessible, but it's sharp and it's fast and it's gripping. And it's great to know, I think, for viewers that it was filmed here, and that really adds to the atmosphere of it.
And it looks stunning.
It really does.
We've had a little sneak preview, haven't we?
In the next few weeks, as we approach the start of the series on the 6th of January, and then as the four-part series plays out on ITV, we'll bring you much more in-depth from behind the scenes of the Bletchley Circle. Not only the filming here at Bletchley Park, but also some interviews we caught in London at a press conference launching the new series.
And we had some cake, didn't we, in ITV? I had quite a bit of cake, actually. It was very nice ITV cake. people will hear in the interviews, you can just tell the pride in the actors' voices when they're talking about being involved with it.
They all mentioned, unprompted, how much of an honour it was to bring Bletchley Park stories to life in some small way, because it draws attention to the real lives of women during and after the war. And it's that key point that I really felt came across very strongly in the first series, and I think will do in this one as well. The secrecy after the war had far-reaching effects on these women's lives. They couldn't tell their husbands what they'd done during the war.
Yeah, I mean, we still see it now, don't we? We interview veterans, and I think probably every single one of them will just say, what I did wasn't important. Oh, I didn't work on Enigma. But it was all part of, we call it a cog in a bigger machine, don't we? And it's being able to tell the veterans, no, you were part of that machine. The pride and the joy in their faces, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, there were really good operational reasons to keep secret from one section what the next section was doing and where it fit into the bigger picture, because you only knew what you needed to know for very good security reasons. So then that leaves people with a diminished sense of importance, possibly, of their part of the process. So they hear about this whole process, this whole complex machine, and they don't know how important their little bit was. It was all important. So in January's episode, we'll take you behind the scenes during filming at Bletchley Park back in the spring and summer. This time, though, a press conference launching the new series. These were embargoed interviews, which we can now bring you, with the cast, the executive producer, and the writer and creator of the series.
Quite good just to start us off. What sparked the idea to feature a storyline surrounding the hanging of a female character for this first opening episode?
Well, it's a very iconic thing, a hanging, isn't it? And I think it's something that, I don't know about you, but my kind of gut reaction is that it's barbaric, and that it's death penalty is something that raises everybody's hackles a bit. I suppose if we were in America, we wouldn't necessarily think like that, but it strikes me as a terrible thing to do. But in the 50s, it was current law, and the idea of somebody being hanged for a capital crime wouldn't perhaps have struck anybody then as being as strange and terrible as it does me now. So it was a very immediate and very instantly graspable, awful way of putting one of our people in peril. And I think that the story has always been about women in peril and women who have been slightly marginalised or slightly forced into outsider roles. And society can't really push you further away from itself than hanging you at the gallows. So, yeah, it seemed like an interesting place to start.
And quite different from, obviously, the first series.
Yes, I think we were all really conscious from the start that we didn't want to tell serial killer storyline after serial killer storyline. This is an investigative show. It's about mysteries, and it's obviously a thriller, but it's not a murder mystery show, and there doesn't have to be a murder to kick things off. In this instance, there is, but in the second of our stories, there isn't, and the stories we're thinking of for the future don't necessarily involve a murder plot. So we wanted to make sure that we kept things fresh, and this does approach the mystery story in a slightly different way, from a slightly different angle, from the perspective of somebody who, in theory, as we start this, is the perpetrator rather than the victim.
Is it nice to be in a show where it's four women doing the solving of the murders, and it's not necessarily a show in which women are being killed and the detectives are always men?
It's fantastic. We drive to work every day with a song in our souls and cause chaos when we get there. It's a privilege, actually. I believe in the spirit of this show. I think it's an export of the best of Britishness, and the fact that that's embodied by four female characters is something we're all incredibly proud of. I think that spirit of resilience, of resourcefulness, They've got that wonderful quiet dignity that comes with having to keep secrets, as I don't think people can in this day and age. They have all the hallmarks of what makes what I like about this country, to be honest. So to be playing characters that are not just foils to men, they're there in their own right, their own storylines are valid, and they're there very much for their own reasons rather than to look pretty or ornery or anything else. It makes it a joy. And, you know, I'm too old now to do scripts that I don't believe in, and I believe in this fervently, so it makes it a pleasure coming to work. Except they make it a bit hard.
Would you agree with that, Julie, as well?
Oh, yes. I mean, working with women is the best. It's fantastic. It really is. And also, you know, you spend so much of your time as an actor being, you know, the only woman or one of, you know, a few with lots and lots of sort of actors. And I mean, don't get me wrong, actors are lovely and all that sort of stuff, set dressing and everything. But it's actually really nice to have to work with the women are the driving force. You know, they are the substance and they are the heart and they are the soul. And also, I just think it's such an interesting take on, I guess, the sort of detective genre. Because at that time, women were... I mean, what's great about the women in Bletchley is that they can work under the radar because people don't expect them to be poking around in other people's businesses. And so they can do that and not... People don't expect them to be... we can get away with a lot more because we can allow ourselves to be patronised, but actually we're the ones that are doing the patronising. So, yeah, it's a joy. It's brilliant.
I mean, I think it's interesting, and we've been talking about other stories today with Guy this morning, how actually easy it is because there's so many stories that haven't been told and how actually those are the way, you know, I think the woman who used to be in charge of someone who goes to visit them out of compassion from this first story, Gina's a way into that story. She led us off in a way that actually is about compassion and about something she believes can't be right, and then just can't stop herself getting involved with, as opposed to, say, Susan in the first series is somebody who, in a way, is frustrated by not being able to solve puzzles and seeing a puzzle about people being repetitively killed being something she just can't resist. They're very different emotional ways into stories. Their methods and their intelligence is common, but I think what's great is there's a great range, both within the characters, in what they're good at, in how they perceive the world. They're united by their intelligence, but they're not the same characters. And I think that's really what's really interesting, is you don't have just, you know, and I don't mean in she's the techie, she's the, you know, to me, you know, they actually definitely have different moral outlooks, as we see in the second two-parter. Millie's character has to come face to face with moral problems within her life and what she's doing and how she's surviving post-war. And also just, I think also what's interesting from the last series, some people, you know, Timothy, you know, people complaining about, you know, oh, his character, and oh, he seems a bit sort of on the sidelines and, you know, not being filled in with what's going on and seeming ignorant of it. And how many times have you seen the wife in the series do that? It was interesting, a lot of people went, yes, and so I thought, you know, it's fine, it's not a war of between the sexes, but it's an interesting reversal of it. I think that's what guys captured and what the girls capture very much. And I think those subtleties about those relationships with each other, they're also not... They're very close friends in the story, but not, as I said, they do have their boundaries with each other.
Well, then also there's a lot of conflict still between them, which I liked, is that they're all, you know, a bunch of women getting together and they're all hugger-mugger. You know, they have huge, you know, conflicts within those relationships as well, and so they're rounded and they're real and they're not necessarily... I mean, I get the impression that from the last series to the next series that they haven't all been hanging out together, you know, they're not all best friends. You know, it's not, you know, Josie and the Pussycats, you know, they had a common experience which was quite traumatic and terrible, but they've actually just gone off and they've made their own way in their life and they've led their own lives, and this one event brings them back together, and still within that they still are conflicted and they still have differences and they still challenge each other in, you know, in their morals and the you know, the way they live and everything. So they're very different women that happen to have a common bond, which was Bletchley.
Mm. I think what Rachel said touched on about a culture of secrecy, I think it's very difficult for our generation, or anybody who lives in this current climate where people seem to share every single instance of their lives, to imagine the sort of common shared value and worth placed in discretion and the stakes that there were during the war in terms of what it would cost to break a secret. So they've lived with that burden, and it wasn't anything that, you know, would have been complained about. There's a sort of stiff upper lip quality, which I think the result would have been of living through Brechin, working those hours, you know, on individually, they each have different roles and would have had different roles, is a sort of a sense of self-discipline, self-reliance, don't pry, you know, there's a sense of boundaries, as Jake said. So, I mean, it feels like there's a sort of just very different cultural values. And what Julie was saying of being able to pry, but having the facade of somebody who's just a bystander, I think.
And
is
also,
really,
I think they must have felt quite, when the women left Bletchley, they must have felt quite isolated and that they couldn't share. And so when they get back together, it's probably quite a relief that they can actually talk about things that went on, and they've got a common experience and they've got a shared experience, and they don't have to keep secrets from each other or from anybody else. And so I think that must have...
Yes, I think, yes, it's that thing, isn't it, of having had a period of their lives where they would have been valued for their intelligence.
Mm.
And that would have been a hugely prized, you know, commodity within the sort of very peculiar microcosm world of Bletchley Park. And then the war ends, you're back in the real world, and what are your outlets in that sort of... A shared frustration where, yeah, so if there's suddenly something to which you can pour your mental energies in.
In terms of the first storyline, and that's what Jean's driving force is, that she sees this girl, obviously a woman, but, you know, she still thinks of her as a Bletchley girl, and she sees the fact that she's, you know, that's the reason she approaches her, is just to offer for moral support, in that they were at Bletchley together, and that's there's no other reason behind it, there's no ulterior motive, it's just to go and show support, because she remembers Alice from Bletchley, and she remembers her being bright and wonderful and, you know, having a bright future, and sees that she's in this awful predicament, and it's not until she goes to see her that her sixth sense is triggered, and that she thinks there's just something not quite right about the story that she's telling and the way that she's behaving. So that's their sort of common starting point, really.
I was just going to say that it's interesting that Jean takes that inroad into the story for us, that it's quite an emotional connection that pulls her in, whereas in the first season what we saw was very much an intellectual connection from Susan, who's bored and who gets into cracking the code of a serial killer case partly in order to satisfy that need for stimulus, and it gets too much. So by this story, Susan's kind of reeling from the aftermath of that and very badly traumatised, and you see in this episode she's very reluctant to be brought back into this. And Jean sees much more of a moral imperative to help somebody in trouble, even if it's just to go and offer her support in person. So it's good fun playing with the different characters and seeing how they bring very differing perspectives to these stories.
But we still need Susan.
Oh, yeah. Well,
we still need... We drag her back in to our evil way.
And I think that's, again, you know, looking at a great range of characters and a great range of actresses, it's really great to have that ability to switch. You know, in the second two parts, we've got a very big story, both for Millie, in terms of her getting in above her head, and actually somebody who's actually, through up until that time, is one of the more confident, and you've never actually seen her in a vulnerable position at all, and Rachel getting her to play the opposite of what she'd been playing for 5 hours so far. I think you had a lot of fun with that, but also we had a lot of fun in stretching. What's great about returning series is not, you know, some murder mysteries, if you like, the leading characters are immutable. They are great detectives, but they don't really change. What they do is they go into different situations with great guest characters. I think we've got a show in which each story changes and reevaluates who our characters are, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses might be now, seeing as what they go through. And that's part of the fun. And I think that makes it more interesting, hopefully, for you as actresses, for the actresses to play, because they're not just playing the same state again and again each time. And
But also there is a huge change in one of the characters, in the Sophie's character Lucy. I mean, she goes through a huge transformation, in that if she hadn't have got together with the girls in the first place, you know, she was trapped in a sort of violent, abusive marriage, and was not, you know, seeing her full potential, and the fact that she got together with these women and got out of the marriage, you know, helped by them. I mean, she goes through a huge change. She, you know, she's now working at Scotland Yard. And, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, that would probably have never happened to that character had she not been, you know, together in, with these women in the first place. So, you know, the, so that is a huge... That character, it changes more than any other character.
She was all... Yes, because for her, she was just a kid when she was at Bletchley, so she's growing up fast.
There was recently that wonderful Mavis Beatty who just died, and there was a wonderful obit I read last night. She was 92, I think, wasn't she, when she died, and held husband did the secrets to her grave. I mean, she spoke a little, but not much. But there was a wonderful quote that Dilly Knox said about Mavis Beatty, whose original name was Lever, and her other code-breaking friend, Somebody Rock, and the two of them had cracked a little bit of the German code, which had resulted in working out where the D-Day landings were going to take place. And Dilly Knox had said, and it was quoted in her obit last week or the week before, Dilly Knox had said, "Give me a lever and a rock and I will move the universe." And of course he was being subversive about it, because that was her single name and nobody knew what on earth he was referring to, except for the women involved themselves. But no, I'm sure they were. They are amazingly technically, probably more so than I can't use Facebook. But yeah, I mean, their stories are still to be told. And I hope that this show has raised, I think it has a bit, the profile of both Bletchley Park. And we saw some of the improvements that are taking place there when we were filming there. And the idea that this had anything to do with that brought about such a great pomp and sense of self-importance. But, you know, if it has anything to do with what the improvements that you're, some of the improvements that you're making there now, then it's a source of huge pride to us all.
There's also a very good thing on the DVD. There's a brilliant interview, you haven't seen it yet, with one of the original Bletchley women, Audrey Wynne, who is amazing.
I think the war was obviously, it was a very cruel time for women, in that a lot of women went into Bletchley Park at the age where they would probably just be, I mean, you know, especially people like Jean, who sort of great, you know, clerical skills, they would go in at a time when they would probably just be about to meet somebody and settle down and get married. And then there's a whole sort of window where the war happened, and then women were suddenly found themselves, I mean, the only option to them was actually to be spinsters. That awful word, there's no male equivalent. And I mean, that was it, you know, there was no opportunity to sort of get married, have children, even have careers. I mean, they literally went into clerical jobs, librarian, all that sort of stuff. And I think there's a certain poignancy about that. And I think, you know, especially for a character like Jean, I think she kind of plods along and she's a very moral and decent person. And I think out of all the women, it's probably more exciting for her than any of them. I mean, this opportunity to sort of, you know, come together and have that sort of camaraderie. And also the fact that she would have been on a different level to the girls. I mean, she was kind of looking after them to a certain extent. And then to actually, you know, to work alongside them. So I think that definitely kind of informs how she develops as a character. But the other thing I love about Jean is that she stays the same, though. She's constant, even though the experience that I think she very much enjoys is that she just is the same.
Except throughout. For in episode 3 when I dress her up.
One of the things that I love in writing Jean as a character is that because when she's at Bletchley, she's a bit older than the other characters. They kind of come into it, I suppose, at just post-university age. She's got some backstory, but we don't know what it is, and we kind of never really find out what it is, but there are these little hints that I've been dropping into the scripts with great, great joy, I have to admit, at the point when she's being dressed up to try to fool the ringleader of a group of very, very, very nasty people, and she's got to carry this impersonation off with enough aplomb that she's not found out. She just says, "Oh, I wasn't always a librarian, you know." And you think, well, what were you then?
I will never tell.
All of us in love with the backstory that could be there. She's got an awful lot of self-assurance, I think, and kind of both moral purpose and drive for somebody who's just a librarian. And I don't know, if we ever tell the full story, I think it's going to be a ripping yarn.
It'll be the last ever episode.
Lots of flashback and battle.
Jean's sorting past.
The other thing I would say just about you don't see her personal life, but I think just a little bit, the girls are her personal life. Yeah. This is about as close to it as it gets. So while the others are going through transformations outside and away from it, actually the circle is about as near to a personal life as Jean seems to have. So you do see it all the time. It just happens to be central to the story.
It's no great accident that she's called Jean. I mean, it's a Miss Jean Brodie reference. My girls. Yeah. So, you know.
Just on a lighter note, Rachel, would you say that, based on what we've just seen in that episode, your character got the best fashion of the day?
No, I don't. I would absolutely. Double tweed.
I said to Anna Robbins on the first day, first series, I said, please will you put Jean in double tweed? And she did. All my wishes.
Triple, actually.
Triple tweed with shoulder pads like that.
Yeah, she gets the best fashion. All right.
Yeah, I get the best fashion.
She gets clothes made for her. We get them off the peg.
I get the budget. The entire budget is spent on me. I mean, we slightly, all of us rankle at this because we wouldn't ask this question if it was a series of blokes. Did you enjoy wearing your double tweed?
But they are fabulous.
But they are fabulous. I really like them. We have these amazing makers, Gerson and Valeria. They're a couple, Italian couple. Anna and I get quite into it, and yeah, so I spend a lot of money. Yeah.
Every interview about clothes undoes all my good work for the entire series.
Yeah.
But the biggest pleasure, apart from, you know, working with these girls, is when we went to Bletchley Park, there's something very moving and very thrilling and very humbling about being in that atmosphere and being able to, you know, thanks to all the great people that work at Bletchley, you know, and that trust us, it's not difficult, it's not a huge stretch to kind of imagine yourself there, because, you know, it's a fantastic privilege to be with these machines, you know, that won the war, effectively. Mm. And we all felt that. We all felt a great kind of sense of respect and to be allowed to be near these fantastic things.
They fabricated an enigma, a German enigma, for the second two parts. And we got to see how this thing worked and try and understand.
And Hattie was amazing. She actually did
work. Hattie got it.
She did. She got it.
Because she's nerdy spice.
Yes. Dorky spice. I'm old spice on this.
I'm posh spice.
So, but that was it was a great privilege, a real privilege.
You're Simon Fuller.
That makes me Simon.
Sarah's mother, the director of the second block, her mother had been at Bletchley.
That's
which
right,
was an
yeah.
extraordinary yeah. sort of full circle. Mm.
Sarah Harding, the second director, she found some of the old photos of her mother with girls outside a pub. Literally her own family's Bletchley Circle, which are quite moving when you see them, and she gets quite, you know, talking about it. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone. That concludes our press
conference. Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.